Hello, my sweet friends. It's been way too long since I recorded my last podcast. Oh my God, how you been doing? Things have been happening, seasons have been changing, and I've been in, I was in Indonesia for a few weeks, which is where I recorded this podcast. It was one fine morning on Uluwatu's Bukit. I was sitting at a little cafe reading a book, and the lovely Jed Smith walked up to me and was like, "Kyle, how are you? Haven't seen you in years." I hadn't seen him since I met him in San Sebastian, and he interviewed me for his awesome podcast that I highly recommend. It's called Ain't That Swell. It's it's the best surf podcast out there. Ain't That Swell. So I go check it out. But he was like, "Dude, let's record a pod." So that is what we did. He interviewed me for a while on this episode. Then I interviewed him. It was just more of a fun conversation that I certainly enjoyed. And then we co-released it. Jed is also a writer. He's worked as a journalist for outlets, including Stab, Surfer's Journal, The Guardian, Vice, and is the host of the award, as he said, the award-winning Degenerate Surf podcast, Ain't That Swell. That's our show. If you enjoyed it, please take 60 seconds and give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Just a few stars really does help. You can head over to tierman.substack.com to check out all of my writing, sign up for the newsletter, get podcasts as soon as they drop. It's all over there at tierman.substack.com, or just click the link in the description below. You can send me voice memos at info@kyle.surf. Just bust out your phone. Let me know who you are, where you're listening from. Keep it under 2 minutes and email the voice memo to info@kyle.surf. Thank you so much to RPM Training for sponsoring this podcast. You can head over to rpmtraining.com, type in the code name Kyle T-Man, and get 10% off all at-home functional fitness gear. By using that code, you are supporting this podcast. You are allowing me to prioritize it. So just go over there to rpmtraining.com, type in the code name Kyle T-Man at checkout, and get yourself some at-home fitness gear. Thank you also to Santa Cruz Medicinals. You can go to scmedicinals.com, type in the code name Kyle10, and get 10% off all potent CBD. I'm looking at some of their CBD-infused coconut oil right above my bed right now. I use it for massages. I use it for sore muscles. You can go to scmedicinals.com, type in the code name Kyle10 at checkout, and get 10% off. By supporting them, you are supporting this podcast. Thank you so much for your time and attention. I do not take it for granted. Get out in the water, whatever body of water you are closest to, ocean, lake, river, bathtub. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.
Excellent. Call Teeman. How the fuck are you?
I'm feeling good. It was nice running into you the other day.
Yeah, man. I couldn't believe my eyes. The last time I saw you in the flesh, it was back in the Basque country, San Sebastian, the Surf Film Festival, Sancho Rodriguez's brainchild. And, man, I've got to say, actually, Sancho, fucking shout out to Sancho. That guy was like a pivotal figure in my life. Like, before the surf film festival that we were at, I spent a couple weeks on his couch once. I feel like it was like a few years earlier. And Sancho is this Basque, intrepid, core-lord, cone fiend, hell man. You know, he's like traipsing through the Ments in the 90s, getting fucking dengue and fucking dysentery and whatever else the jungle can throw at you. And with the King Millennium
Back
boys.
Back when the Ments were dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're still dangerous if you if you blow too many out there, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
You're fucking skinned at that joint.
Yeah, San Sebastian, that's a cool spot, man. They were premiering the Ramon Navarro film, The Fisherman's Son, and I was doing a little tour with the Patagonia crew.
Yep, Cole Christensen was there.
Cole Christensen was there.
One of the goats.
One of the goats.
All-time goats, man. He's got, I reckon he has the goat non-make it cloud break. I think that tube is like, almost stands alone. It's in it. I don't know if it's been bettered, but
he's also the Hunter S. Thompson of surfing. Dude. I have a great Cole story. I was on the North Shore and I hit up Cole and I was like, hey, like, what's up, Cole? I know you. You're a Hawaiian. Are you going to be cool to me while I'm in Hawaii? And he's like, oh yeah, Kyle, what's up? Let's go surf this spot. I'm like, cool, right on. He shows up at my little spot, and he's like, take this business card out of my glove box. And I'm like, all right. So I take the business card out, and he's like, peel off a corner of the business card. And it has a Cole business card on it.
Yep.
And he said, peel off a corner of the business card and put it on your tongue.
No. He's dipped his business cards in lysergic? Are you kidding me?
And wow. We commenced to have a great LSD surf sesh at a wave on the North Shore. And as we're walking through this path, that leads to this cool little zone, there's a yoga class of women on surfboards, and they're doing like a stand up paddle yoga surf class in flat water, because to paddle out to this wave we were going to, like, it's flat water in this little area, and
are
then
you
go out
me?
And they're in line, like almost kind of like perpendicular to the beach, and Cole and I look at each other and we're like, you thinking what I'm thinking? Like, yeah. And we just paddle through this line of women doing yoga on the beach and out to the fucking most fun little rippable 2 to 3 foot waves, and it was an LSD trip I will never forget.
Man, that's the thing about LSD trips. You never forget them. I can tell you every stinking detail of every time I've taken a significant dose of psychedelics. And that's, you know, something to be said for me having, you know, I mean, I've had my fucking head punched in by so many different cultures of people back in Australia. And, yeah, to the tune of, you know, 12 to 15 concussions, as people listeners to this show know well. And my short-term memory's a little bit banged up, but never when I take psychedelics, man, it's crazy. It creates this neural circuitry that just leaves the most vivid imprints of every little fucking thing that happened in that journey. Cole, also, when I met him on his avocado farm there at Wailua, I believe. He was running like a woofing avocado farm.
Woofing. So what is it? The willing worker. It's basically a way for you to get stay on a farm if you're willing to work.
Right. And there was a yoga session going down, and yes, of, you know, he offered me the obligatory dose of liquid LSD. I said no at the time, but, you know, kind of regret that now. And as it happened, I bumped into him again at the Steel Pulse concert in Waikiki. You know, Steel Pulse?
Of
course. You've got to be familiar with Steel Pulse. And since then, yeah, just, you know, had a... just the correspondences here and there with Cole, but one of the great stories he told me, and this was a story that was published in, I can't remember who I wrote it for. Might have been the Surface Journal or Tracks Magazine, but Cole's first trip outside of Hawaii, you probably know this, was to Rapa Nui.
Oh, yeah.
AKA Easter Island, AKA the most isolated island in the world, 5,000 kilometers off the coast of Chile in the Pacific. And he went there in the, fuck man, it was a long time ago. He was like 18 years old. And, you know, there's fuck all cars on the island. And so you're actually riding horses around from surf break to surf break. The people are like Polynesian, I think. It's like a kind of a mix of.
Well, they have the big stone statues.
That's what it's famous for, right?
Yeah. It's famous for the stone statues and also the desertification of an island. So the history goes that the people cut down all the trees and destroyed all the resources on this island paradise.
What do they call that? The commons, right?
Tragedy of the commons.
Tragedy of the commons. Cutting down the branch you're all sitting on, literally. And it also is famous, I found out via Cole, for a bunch of psycho slabs that are, it's basically, yeah, super Hawaiian-esque style waves, but with a lot of urchins and limited access to the waves, you know, like fucking gnarly. And it just gets hammered by swell. And so he's there as a 19-year-old kid riding horses from wave to wave with his 7.2 gun and surfing with no one, and it's 10 to 15 foot, and that's what he did for 6 to 8 months, I think he spent there.
Yeah, and he goes back all the time. He's spent a lot of time down in Chile. He's the kind of guy who's just always gone to the beat of his own drum. At first glance, just seems like a bit head in the clouds, and you spend time with him, and you're like, no, you have this all figured out. You have this all figured out, and you're just not letting on how smart you are.
Man, he's like kind of the Hawaiian version of Kemmel. You know Kemmel, Jeff Goulden?
No.
Kemmel's like, it's like, in my mind, the like two great Indo ferals of all time, or actually not of all time, of say my generation roughly, Travis Potter and Kemmel. Kemmel lived in the jungle at G-Land for years, and just it was in the 90s, and just was an intrepid Indo dude who, yeah, he's from West Oz originally, Toomey's guy, but again, just like on face value, you don't think he's that onto it. You know, he just seems like a bit slow moving and not super sharp, but man, the guy is wily as a fox and fucking packs it with the best of him. He's an underground legend in Australia, and I put Cole kind of in that bracket. Yeah, they're all just like, yeah, just unassuming, very humble, very kind, loving people, so easy to get along with. Have a chat with anyone, and yeah, they're all, you know,
has structured his life in such a way that he's going on awesome adventures. He installs solar panels too for a living,
right?
So he has this job with business cards, where yeah, it allows him to surf for Patagonia, do solar, go on amazing surf trips, and then he's also really into splitboarding. So he goes on rad snow trips too.
True.
Yeah, it's a good crew, man. The Patagonia team is full of interesting cats.
I reckon it is. Like Ramon Navarro, who you mentioned. Wow, what an interesting character. I mean, just put South American big wave surfing on the map, like in the craziest way possible, coming screaming through one of the waves of that 2012 swell in Fiji. You know, he's kind of a household name before that. But, you know, that just really, for me, validated the level of technical surfing in those kinds of conditions coming out of that part of the world. I mean, fuck, the man at Punta de Lobos, obviously.
Have you been down there?
No, never. Love to go there, man. Yeah. Love to go there. But, man, so good to have you here. Fuck, it's amazing. Second stint on the show. First stint alongside me, good mate Zach Weisberg, aka the head shaman at the Inertia. And mate, shout out to Zach, one of the greats. But good to have you back. I mean, you're well on the path then, but since then, you've gone on to become, you know, what I reckon is one of the most worldly and accomplished guys in surfing, full stop. Like, you know, great podcast, the Kyle Tierman Show, fucked up podcast. The guests you've had on there, unbelievable. Like, Rogan-esque in its scope of people, James Fadiman, Matt Taibbi, all the way to Mark Healy, Jamie Mitchell, and fucking a million other people. Yeah. Captain Liz Clark. And then, you know, you got that YouTube series, Surfing for Change. You're riding now. We're actually dosed to fuck on Mudwater right now, who's kind of the benefactor of an incredible publication, Trends with Benefits, which is another one of your projects. You've got so much stuff going on. And then beyond all that, you've managed to keep your surfing so tight, you know, at Mavericks, not packing tubes, but I mean, you probably packed a couple, but fuck, man, you know, dropping into big waves there, packing them in the Mance in Sumbawa. Mate, you're living, you're flying by the seat of your pants, you're living, and it's amazing to see the trajectory you're on. and to understand.
I'm gonna hang out with you more, man. You're my fucking hype man, bro. I haven't felt this good about myself in a long time.
Sometimes people need to spell it out for you. You know,
no, like, I feel so rudderless. Often I'm like, what am I even doing? But then everyone else, I can like tell their story with like this great arc. But I feel like telling the story of yourself is sometimes the hardest.
Yeah.
Because you're like, you're too close to it. I feel like I'm a dog chasing cars most of the time.
Can feel like that too, because there's no tangible product at the end of the day. It's just words. And it can feel somewhat unsatisfying not to have, you know, a door frame that you've built at the end of the day, or a wall you've put up, or a fucking pineapple that you've grown. We're just out here talking shit, but we're actually in the game of spreading ideas, spreading consciousness. And man, I mean, tell us about some of the work you're doing. You mentioned it off air a second ago, at Mudwater.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, we're just talking about it. America is a place of extremes. You got on one hand, fucking elementary school shootings and high school massacres. And on the other end of the spectrum, we've got what you're doing. The shit you're doing is so fucking tapped and high end. Tell us a bit about what's going on behind the scenes at Mudwater.
Well, you mentioned James Fadiman, who, for people who don't know, is one of the foremost researchers of psychedelics and specifically microdosing.
Dude, I call myself the maestro of microdosing. But in fact, it's James Fadiman.
In fact, it is James Fadiman. Yeah, he's the guy who was there from the beginning with Tim Leary, and the first time he ever did LSD was with Ram Dass at a little cafe in France. And was conducting a lot of the leading research at Stanford for psychedelics and psychedelic-assisted therapy in the 60s. And he loves telling the story of how in 1970, when Nixon put a kibosh on the whole thing, largely due to Timothy Leary, who was this great psychedelic luminary, but went to the extreme saying, we should put psychedelics in the water, and it really, you know, he was called the most dangerous man in America.
I'm going to take umbrage with that, though. Like, I mean, that he might have been the fall guy that Nixon blamed it on, but you look at MKUltra and some of these, like, CIA, that CIA program in particular, they were looking for reasons to discredit the left, whether it be, you know, the Black Panthers, the anti-war movement, and now we're going to stop it. Nothing to do that. And they could see the potential for LSD and mushrooms and marijuana to destabilize so many of the cornerstones of capitalism, that being the military-industrial complex, the pharmaceutical drug complex, the prison-industrial complex. Like, and it's my belief that, maybe he became public enemy number one, but in reality, Nixon was just a fucking another hawkish puppet of the deep state, and he had to shut that shit down, and he set fucking human evolution back about 50 years. Right. Like, there's like someone pressed pause on human evolution the day
well, one thing's for sure, Timothy Leary said, these kids are going to take psychedelics and they're not going to fight in your wars, which is true.
Yep.
And that was what really scared the establishment.
100%.
So that's when they scheduled LSD as a Schedule I drug. And meanwhile, Fadiman's doing all of this really promising research. And he told me a story once about getting this letter from one government agency and said, you need to shut down your program immediately. And he looked at his co-researcher and he said, meanwhile, they were having participants in who were tripping mid-session. And he says, I think we got this letter tomorrow.
Yeah.
So he ended up being my neighbor.
Really?
Yeah. So Fadiman was my neighbor, and there's this fun little wave where I grew up in Santa Cruz that I would bike down the road to just about every day. Turned out he lived right on that road. And when I started my podcast in 2018, it initially was just a way to do peer journalism with big wave surfers.
Mm-hmm.
We would go surf Mavs, and I had the chance to sit down on the mic with guys like Sean Dollar and Jamie Mitchell and Flea, and like just talk about it from a perspective that was really fun, because it was like I was out there too, and it wasn't this like outsider looking in. And that was the inception of the podcast, but really quickly I learned that there aren't many rules in podcasting, mm-hmm. and you can go wherever your curiosity leads you, and it's actually imperative to do that if you want to keep it interesting. Mm-hmm. So I was always curious about psychedelics. I had done psychedelics. Already a lot of the breakthrough science was coming out. And when I learned that Fadiman was my neighbor, he was one of the first guests that I had on, and it gave way to this really lovely friendship, mentorship.
Amazing.
And since then that's probably what I've focused most of my journalism on in the past 2 years is this revolution in psychedelics and psychedelic assisted therapy. And have had a lot of people on my show who are in the psychedelics movement. And then just 3 years ago, one of my childhood friends, Shane Heath, started a company called Mudwater, mm-hmm. which was going gangbusters and having crazy success. And he said, I want one of the cornerstones of our business to be backing psychedelics and psychedelic assisted therapy. So if you're interested, I'd like you to help run a media outlet that we create called Trends with Benefits that talks about psychedelics, tracks this with journalism, and it's been quite the journey, man. I mean, it's amazing how when you fly that little beacon up, just about everyone has taken psychedelics or knows someone who has and has interesting, you know, there are such great insights to be derived from these substances when taken responsibly. And it's such a fundamental shift in medicine because it's so reliant on intention. Whereas current mainstream medicine usually just says, hey, take this pill, mm-hmm. you're going to feel this certain way. But with psychedelics, it can offer any number of options on the platter from elation to terror, depending on how your mindset going into it, mm-hmm. and the setting in which you take these substances, because they're so neuroplastic, they make your mind so suggestible. It's important to take them with the kind of reverence and respect that they deserve. And that's really one of the only kinds of medicine that it takes the person doing that kind of participation to get the result that they want.
Right. And tell us a bit about this kind of hazing ritual at Mudwater that you guys have got going on. So for fresh employees, this is the best kind of hazing. This is the kind of hazing you want in your business. None of this toxic masculinity, like groping chicks on the way through and fucking chortling while you're burying your face in a bowl of blow and sipping champagne from between the fucking synthetic norks of some stripper. None of that. That's fucking Wolf of Wall Street shit. We're going the other direction. Tell us a bit about what you guys do.
We're weird little hippies. We do breath work, and when we have a new employee in Mudwater, we do an hour-long holotropic breath work session.
Yes!
With the whole team. And what's funny is it's like, you know, some of us are surfers. We kind of grew up in this alternative culture, but some of it, like, it's also a business, so you have some pretty straight people there too. And the most fun is when you see them start to switch. And they've never done anything, you know, they haven't even done yoga, and all of a sudden they're like bawling, crying 30 minutes into this breathwork session, like, I never knew my father, fuck! And you're like, yeah, we're doing good work here, bro, this is awesome.
Wow, big trauma release on the way into your job, that's insane. Oh man, that's so classic. Like, a big theme, it's so tripped out. Just did a couple podcasts with Kobe Abedin, and we're just talking at length about breath work and what it's done for his life, what it's done for my life. And it seems to be the answer to literally everything. Everything. Like, as good as psychedelics are, you know, breath work and meditation, it's kind of a more gradual entry point into the same state of consciousness. But once there, once you connect with that consciousness, man, it brings a level of accountability and truth to the individual, that it safeguards your business. You know, you can't have a corrupt, you know, insidiously lazy employee if they're doing routine breath work every day, or, you know, big group sessions, It's not possible. You somehow channel this fucking Buddha nature or Christ consciousness or whatever you want to talk about, whatever you want to call it, sorry, and it just makes you a undeniably better and more accountable person, and it's fucking good for everyone around you too.
I'm a big fan of it. You know who Alan Watts is, right?
Yeah.
He did a lot of writing about consciousness and altered states of consciousness, but he wasn't as bullish on psychedelics as Tim Leary and a lot of these other guys. And someone once asked him, like, well, why not? And he said, psychedelics are a microscope, and you don't want to live your whole life looking through a microscope. Which is, I really find that to be true. It's like, you know, the when you get the message, hang up the phone line.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
And I think that a lot of people can get stuck in taking too many psychedelics, and I think that it can really mess people up. Frankly, if you're taking them often in settings where you're not really being careful, it can kind of make you a bit rudderless, in my opinion. Whereas breath work is it's so much less risky, and you can still enter into those altered states of consciousness and then ground straight back down.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't have the same risk profile, and it's a practice that you can do daily to kind of tap in mm-hmm. with yourself. And it's just cool, man. I think that our generation is learning a lot of these skills, and I think it's largely due to podcasts, man.
100%, man. We were having this convo the other night at dinner, I think, or at lunch, sorry, where I was explaining something I learned, which is that podcasts... it was explained to me that podcasts are the most significant thing to happen to information technology since the printing press, and for much the same reasons. It's democratized information flows. There's no gatekeepers anymore. And just as the printing press gave rise to the Age of Enlightenment, podcasts are creating a new Age of Enlightenment, and it's doing it in exactly the same way. With the printing press, that gave birth to scientific journals. All the leading academics and scientists on the planet were able to give out their information freely, and podcasts, it's the exact same thing. Like, you know, whether it's the Huberman Lab or Rhonda Patrick or Dr. Mark Hyman or Drew Perroid or Joe Rogan, like, they're handing us back the keys to our internal state. And man, that is so powerful, because this entire matrix that we live in, this failing system that's crumbling all around us in a process that Adam Curtis calls hypernormalization, like, it's going to seed. And the only thing that you can really do to get back the power is to take control of your internal state. And our generation's doing it, man. We're fucking doing it because we have to. We're staring down the barrel of some scary shit. And
Adam Curtis, he did Century of the Self.
Yeah, that's right. Century of the Self.
A really interesting series.
Fuck, man. He has so many films, and they are all so incredible. Quite bleak viewing. Like, he's an unapologetic truth teller. But, you know, you got to, you know, the truth will set you free, as they say, and there's no true adage. But, yeah, man.
So who are you listening to most right now? Like, who are the people that you really look to for good information, whether it's information on health or philosophy?
Yeah, I'll go with I listen to the Be Here Now Network, which is Ram Dass's podcast. Like, there's like fucking hundreds of his lectures.
I've listened to those.
Yeah,
they're so good,
incredible. I mean, but that said, like, Ram Dass is a bit esoteric and waffly at times. I really enjoy this guy Drew Perroit, who is the business partner of Dr. Mark Hyman. And it's just science journalism, basically. You know, he's not a scientist himself, but he always has the leading experts in whatever field. And, you know, I've been on this path for maybe close to 5 years, I guess, where when all the news about CTE broke, about like what repeated concussions can do to you. You know, I grew up playing a heavy combat sport, being rugby league, and grew up in a kind of dysfunctional, violent, single parent home, and there's a lot of violence leading up to the age of like 22. So I kind of freaked out when all that news broke, and I just went on this warpath to educate and upskill myself, and it's led me to all these podcasts, biohacking podcasts, and all these methods, this methodology that I do every day, basically, when I'm at home, which is wake up, Wim Hof like 20 minutes. I'll meditate for 20 minutes to half an hour. I'll then do like the Wim Hof push-ups, and I'll get in my chest freezer ice bath. I'll either go surfing or do yoga if there's no waves. I will microdose, and then I'll aim to like exercise again in the afternoon.
You're like, and then it's dinner time.
Yeah, no, seriously.
I'm gonna do a satire about someone's morning routine, bro, that just goes until dinner time.
It fucking takes. If I procrastinate, that shit takes hours, and it's like,
I feel great. I'm ready to take on the day. shit. Time for my evening ritual now.
Seriously. I mean, it's such a indulgence to have the time to do that through the job that I do working for myself. But, you know, I've condensed my working days into a lot less. I don't believe we should be working more than 4 days a week anyway. Fuck. Like, yeah. Man, there's so much, yeah, silly.
Well, you know, I'll tell you one thing, man, since getting a jobby job, so they say, you know, which I had never really had before MUD, I realized that your employer largely controls your mental health.
100%, yeah.
They're controlling most of your waking hours.
Mm-hmm.
And if the managers and leadership aren't setting up a thoughtful scaffolding to allow their employees to thrive and grow mentally and spiritually, and even just having that on their radar, it can create a really destructive space mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that has been really cool to watch as MUD Water's a startup is we do every other Friday off. We have no meetings before noon, which is also just a very powerful hack to be so that people can have that free time to at least wake up and be like, okay, I'm a human on a rock and it's spinning through vast vacuum space. Okay, let's start this up. But if you're just assaulted from the moment you wake up, I mean, we've all been there. You can't really be the chess player. All of a sudden you're a chess piece. And I think that that's where a lot of people kind of spin out. That's where I always spin out is when I feel rushed.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we are so rushed by the systems or the mechanisms of the system we live in, namely like crippling debt pressure, house prices, cost of living. You know, it doesn't leave any room to breathe. You know, you're up and you're just fucking in the commute already before you've like wiped the sleep out of your eyes. You're drinking coffee on the way to work in your car. You know, you got fucking all these like family obligations. You know, both parents are often working now to service these debts. It's fucking borderline unlivable, man. And we're seeing the evidence of that. You know, mental health is at, you know, abysmal levels in the Western world. And we have none of the tools to survive a crippling system like that. Like at least here in Bali and in the rest of Indonesia, which is, you know, Muslim, Bali is Hindu, obviously, their faith is so strong that, you know, in all of these ancient religions, there are so many tools that we're just kind of happen to reinvigorate now with our own Western kind of language and shit. But they've been doing this for thousands of years.
We're like, breath work. We started that shit. And they're like, have you ever heard of Tummo breathing? We were doing that 2,000 years ago.
Seriously, yeah, exactly. And I mean, I don't think it really matters who started it or whatever. It's totally besides the point. It's just fucking just do it.
Yeah, but there is this. I do think that there is this resurgence and this blend between ancient wisdom and modern science,
mm-hmm,
that is really attractive for young people right now, and the results are immediate.
100%. And shout out to the Tibetan Buddhist Mingyur Rinpoche and the Dalai Lama. You know, these guys have always been on the vanguard of getting their religious practices tested by fMRI scans, and they live for this shit, man. The Tibetan Buddhists are fucking so high-end in that respect. I think they've been really on the vanguard of that. Wim Hof, too. You know, I've read his book. He's, you know, basically my hero in life. I don't have heroes per se, but he's the guy who's I respect his journey. He's like a, to me, like a biblical figure. yeah. Really, like a blue collar guy who
blue collar biblical figure.
Yeah, and the fact he rejects that title makes him even more biblical. Like, fuck, so would have Jesus, you know, back in the day. Like, Jesus was just a carpenter who did a lot of good shit for people, and Wim Hof's the same thing. You know, he lost his wife to suicide and went on this crazy hero's journey and whatever, whatever. But, you know, he, again, has basically brought these traditions from the East to the West and vetted them with cutting-edge science. And that's enabled us to get to this point where we're like, yeah, look, it's undeniable what this shit does. Otherwise, it stays in that woo-woo realm. And
yeah. It's interesting what you said about how he went on his own hero's journey, because I think that a lot of people come to these kinds of practices when they're going through their own journey of sorts. Right before COVID hit, I got out of an 8-year relationship. And if anyone has gone through that experience, you know that it's fairly derailing spiritually. And when COVID hit, I was like, fuck, I'm out of here. I bought this old 1997 Ford RV named Starflight. And I was went out to Colorado to meet a friend. And I was planning on being out there for 2 weeks. Ended up taking this road trip through Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana for 4 months. And would just do shout outs on the podcast, and someone would be like, hey, what's up, dude? I'm Dylan from Missoula, Montana. You should come cruise with our Missoula River Surfers for a week. I'm fuck yeah, let's do it. Hey, what's up? I'm Kevin from Colorado. Like, come fly fish with me. And throughout this whole journey, I had no routine. It was marked by elation and loss and freedom and depression, and there were just these wild emotional swings that I was feeling as I was driving through this unfamiliar part of America that's gorgeous. I mean, those states, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, are so vast and powerful, and a lot of these towns are marked by these sinuous rivers that flow through. And I started cold plunging in the rivers, dude. And I would plunge in, and I would grab one of the rocks, and I would let my legs flow up and just be there, closing my eyes in this cold water, not really sure what was next for me. And then I would go back to my RV, a lot of time alone, a lot of time writing, not sure where to go next. And I found that I had to ground myself with these rituals. So I would sit in my little bed, this little fucking RV bed, and I would do breath work. Didn't have a TV to distract myself. Had the Sam Harris meditation app.
Yep.
Do the waking up. Mm-hmm. And grew a lot. I mean, it was hard, but I grew a lot. And I came to a lot of those practices because I just needed some kind of more to kind of tie my spiritual ship to during that time on the road.
Yeah, I mean, adversity is where the growth happens. It's interesting what you said too. You know, one thing I realized during COVID actually, and via reading this book, Lost Connection by Johan Hari.
Yeah. I'm trying to get him on the Trends with Benefits podcast.
Fucking get him on that. He's a legend, very intelligent guy. But one thing I realized is that it actually doesn't matter what you do in terms of creating that routine and structure. If you're socially isolated, fuck, dude, you will never be happy either. Social isolation is one of the quickest routes to mental illness that there is. This was a crazy revelation to have, and it was actually during a big dose of mushrooms that I realized this, because I'd been socially isolating deliberately because I thought I had COVID for the 5 days prior to taking this dose, and man, I got the fucking the set wrong on that one. Got fucking hammered. But social isolation, dude, it's an insidious one. It's fucking gnarly. It's just something about it. Like, I mean, there's a reason, I guess, why solitary confinement is the ultimate torture for prisoners, right? Like, when you're locked up on your own, or when you're on your own, it's like you lose the pace of life because you're not connecting with someone. It's like you lose the tempo of how to think, how to breathe, and how to talk. And your thoughts start to spiral off and become so fast that it creates shallow breathing, and it intoxifies your whole fucking system.
And so, you have these thought loops usually, they're usually destructive, and they're usually focused on the self,
mm-hmm.
which is a breeding ground for depression.
Rumination is a cancer, as
right? They say. So the happiest I ever am is when I'm out reporting a story
mm-hmm.
or doing a podcast, because I'm not usually thinking about myself. My attention is on the external world,
mm-hmm.
and that's a great place because you're just noticing the world. You're not tripping out on what a loser you are, or how your life's not working out, or basically telling stories about yourself that are usually so uncharitable. No one would ever tell that same story about you. But when you're up some dirt road in fucking Bozeman, Montana, in your RV with no one around to check you, it can get dark really fast.
Mm.
And if you don't have those rituals to ground yourself, including journaling, which I find incredibly helpful because it forces you to finish those thoughts.
Mm.
So if you're like, I'm a loser, I suck, it just writing it out on the page is really powerful because you get to test whether or not it's true.
Hmm.
And often it does feel like a physical repository for thoughts.
Wow.
Just writing it down feels like it you're like vomiting it out onto the page, and it's getting out of your head. And it also is beyond just helping with depression, journaling's a really powerful tool for retention. So if you have a hard time remembering new things or learning new things, developing a habit where at night or in the next morning, you just write about some things that happened the day prior, whether it's like a new word that you wanted to learn or a person you met or a story, you just write it down in a journal, and it grooves that neural pathway so that you can remember it.
Yeah, I remember studying for my end of school exams, and one of the statistics I came across was something that, you know, you retain like 20 to 30% of what you read and like 70 to 80% of what you write down. But what you mentioned about journaling and getting those thoughts out and actually having to, you know, face up to the self beatdowns, like see it there in print. Fuck, that's like so powerful and for sure would have to sap some of the power out of those thoughts, because they are fucking ridiculous, man. Once you see them written down, you must just be like that. That's a bit, little bit absurd. That's a bit much. Like, just like, you know, me telling you about your achievements also seems quite powerful in a different way. I mean, it's all true. Like, but it's not until you write it down or hear it said about you, you're like, fuck yeah, I've done some shit.
Yeah, yeah, it's cool. And I've just in the last year too applied journaling to surfing, because that. I was traveling all summer. It was the longest stint I had away from surfing since I started. And when I got back to Santa Cruz that October, I think I traveled, it was like March, April, or so it was like May, June, July, August, September. I was on the road and doing all this shit that I was not good at, like going climbing with guys, going fly fishing, went on a hunting trip, and just so many new, unfamiliar experiences. I've been hunting the last few years, but the other stuff, very little. And then got back to Santa Cruz in October, and the fucking tap got turned on, and we had the best winter at Mavericks ever.
Ah, yeah, this is the winter that Mel got his fucking Mondo cone out there, yeah.
Multiple of them. And yeah. I was still living in my RV, so I would just drive from Santa Cruz up to Half Moon Bay, which is this cool like zone where Mavericks is, and camp out at Half Moon Bay, because it was like day after day after day at Mavs. And I would just keep my big boards in the RV, and I had all these routines and like habits. I would like do my breath work. I'd go out, get a session out there, journal about it. And it was, I had never done that to my surfing. I felt like such an idiot, but I was like, holy shit. Okay. I was sitting not deep enough, and I would write that down. Like, okay, I was sitting too far inside, or I felt like my board was not really working. I'm going to try these different fins. And I got to be very experimental with it. And because we had so many sessions, I probably had like 30 sessions out there through the winter, maybe 30, 40 sessions. I got to try different stuff out, which is rare when surfing big waves. So often when a big swell hits, you're just like, fuck, holy, this is heavy. I want to get a few. But when you get day after day, you get to analyze it and try different things out. And because of that, it was really the best winter of surfing I've ever had. And I think that it was a huge amount of it was due to the habits that I had cultivated the summer prior while not surfing at all.
Man, that's fascinating. I'm fascinated to know as well, like, talk to us a bit about the scene at Mavericks, the setup, you know, on those big days. I'm sure there were some particular standout sessions, but yeah, I mean, how's the lineup work? How does the pecking order work? I mean, it's super long periods there. Like, what's going on? Is like, fuck, how long are you waiting for sets? Like, I'm just so interested in the mechanics of that lineup and that scene.
Yeah, it's a special place. So it's a little over an hour north of where I grew up in Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz has lots of point breaks, lots of diversity in waves. Half Moon Bay has less waves, but they have Mavericks, which is the reef out there breaks out of super deep water, and it's shaped up sort of like a finger going vertically into the shore, which is why it's this deep water slab, really, and it breaks more or less in the same place every time. So you can get super close on a boat. You can also, you know, one reason why you can break a world record out there is that you can sit in the spot and sort of know where the spot is for a 60-foot faced wave to come in, which you can't really do at a wave like Nazaré, right, where you guys are. I haven't surfed out there, but guys out there, when they're paddling, it's like, it seems like you could just get so cleaned up by a wave that breaks 300 yards outside of you or to the left or to the right. Whereas Mavericks, it's kind of one spot every time. There's two bowls out there. So there's the main bowl, which is where you can sit deep. And then there's a bowl a little bit more on the shoulder called Late's Bowl. And that's actually where a lot of the tallest waves will come in at Mavericks. And they're usually less slabby.
Mm.
That's where you can get, it's a little bit easier at Late's Bowl, but you can still get a really big one that shifts wide.
Mm-hmm.
When Kelly Slater got second at Mavericks years ago, apparently he was just sitting at Late's Bowl. And he was just like, I'm going to sit here and catch big ones that are easier to drop in. And you guys, like Flea and Pete and all those guys, were just airdropping from the deeper bowl, which is more of a slab. Mm. A lot of guys in recent years have started to tackle the left more.
Wow. Yeah. I think that's a Torrey Meister.
Torrey Meister.
Packing one out there.
Lucas Chumbo comes over a lot. And it's a fucking psycho wave. I'm regular foot and just don't think I'm good enough to knife it under one of those barrels. But it's been really sick to watch a lot of those guys go left. In recent years, the left only breaks to a certain size. So maybe like 25 foot Mavericks, it'll still break. And once it gets bigger than that, the left sort of closes out and it breaks a little bit further out. But interestingly enough, a lot of the worst beatings that people get are on the smaller days.
Hmm.
The day that Mark Fu died, for example, was not a huge day, but the inside waves will bowl up on that finger reef, and what Mavericks is known for is the beating, and it'll just suck you to the bottom of the ocean.
Hmm.
And then it'll pull you in. And the wave regains power, so it doesn't just dissipate. And on a lot of those inside waves, you'll get worked, and you'll be like, okay, I feel like I'm going to come up now. And it'll feel like it gains more energy.
Wow.
So you can get these really long hold downs that will pull you in to this boneyard area that is full of rocks. And usually if you get, like, three waves on the head, you'll be in the boneyard zone, and it's recommended to probably take your leash off, because one thing that happened to Flea out there years ago was he got caught, he got his leash caught on one of the rocks and almost died out there. So people say if you're going to get a few on the head, you can get washed through the rocks, but it's probably smart to take your leash off there. And it's, you know, it's a wave that's crowded, and especially on the big days, everyone flies over. But it's a lineup that is pretty merit-based. I think that it's one of those lineups where if you go out there and you show respect and you really want it, you can get a wave. You know, people will snap if you go out and it's your first session and you're like back paddling guys, or if you're paddling for too many waves and then not going, that's pretty fucking annoying, because in a lot of big wave sessions, there's long waits and you're sitting out there, and if you fall on those waves, Greg Long has been a real mentor to me. He's a super good friend, and I do most of my traveling with him. And he once told me, he's like, when you're surfing big waves, it's kind of like having lives in a video game. And you have like, you have like four lives. Let's say you have four lives before it's game over that day.
Yeah.
And if you're falling on waves that size again and again, even if you're not getting injured, you're just going to get so depleted that you're going to want to get, you're going to get over it. So pick and choose your waves well out there. And I've sort of taken that approach. Like, and that was one thing that kind of shifted for me, because I've been surfing out there since maybe I was like 22. And I had a really good mentor early on named Tyler Fox, he was a Maverick surfer. He was actually my housemate, super talented small wave surfer too. So he had that kind of like small wave agility. He would go left out there. He would get really big ones on the right, make the final at Mavs pretty much every year. And he was really calculated. So he taught me a lot of safety going into it. And we would go up to Mavericks and there'd be a really big swell, but the fog would be set in and he'd be like, no, it's too dangerous. We're not going to go out today. So I was really grateful that I had someone like him early on to introduce me to it in a more calculated way, because I have the kind of personality that is not very calculated. I grew up skateboarding. I was always like the fucking kid who would like ollie off the roof and be like, fuck it, like this is sick, and like slamming was like the best part. Oh yeah, this is rad. And I went out there, you know, the first couple of years, and I was just kind of slamming way more than I wanted to, largely because I would just get caught up at the lip and I would be doing these fucking hero airdrops and just face planting in the bowl, and it's not as cool after a little while. And I sort of realized, like, okay, you gotta figure this out, and I don't want to be one of those kooky big wave surfers that just like sends it and doesn't make waves. So I really started like looking at a lot of footage and dialing it down, and just realizing how important that entry is, like just to not just like whip it and then stay at the top of the lip, but to be very intentional about the waves are moving so fast, you need to make it to the bottom of the lip, and you need to intend that you're going to get to the bottom of that face and paddle with all of your power to the bottom of that face, and not be the guy who's paddling out when the set is coming and then whipping it and being too far on the lip.
Yeah, you generate so much speed paddling to knife it.
Yeah, you need to generate the speed, and you kind of need to hold the line on a lot of those sets. You need to be like, okay, everyone's paddling out, I'm gonna sit and then be right in the spot when the set comes. So that was a big learning that I had over the past couple of years. And I was stoked because, yeah, this last year when we had really good waves, I didn't wipe out a ton, caught some really fun waves. And it just felt like a cool personal journey a bit too. Like it was less, it's a weird thing when you, you know, growing up in Santa Cruz and kind of getting into big wave surfing, because you can get a lot of pats on the back.
Mm.
And then there's a bit of pressure when you're out there to be like, fuck, I got a good one, or I need to get a good one. And I think it's an unhealthy mental space to, you know, hang your hat on.
When you're doing it for the wrong reasons, which is, you know, a wrong reason is always to be doing it for external validation. If you're surfing according to the whims of the crowd, like, you always pay a fucked up price for that, I reckon. You always get hurt and flogged.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to want it. You got to be doing it purely for yourself, for your own. I mean, for me, it's, I just set the intention simply to ride energy at this stage of my surfing life. And, the moment I start to think about, you know, oh, what are the people in the lineup thinking right now about, you know, I'm up, I got to go this set. Like, that's when I get hurt. I start to, I'm thinking about that, other people's judgment, instead of concentrating on, you know, the wave I'm choosing to go and then my positioning on that wave, and I get fucking lit up.
Yeah. Yeah. And Mavericks is such a special place. You know, to go out there, you know, another thing that I say just about people who are considering surfing that wave is that there's a lot of other waves that can scare the shit out of you and are really good stepping stones to that wave. I think that just because Mavs has the name, a lot of people go from, like, they just have the attitude where, like, I got to surf Mavericks. I got to say that I surf Mavericks. And in reality, I think it's a lot smarter and more sustainable to get into surfing bigger waves.
100%.
And see if you really like it.
Of course. Like, that would seem to be common sense, but yet so many people would fall into the trap of not doing that.
Well, they think that the famous big waves are the only big waves,
mm.
which is just not true. It's like, dude, go to Uluwatu on that last swell, mm-hmm. and there were some bombs that you could push yourself on. And I think that that is a place where you can kind of get to know what your metabolism is for big wave surfing in less life-threatening situations. I interviewed Mark Healy once, and I asked him some question about big wave surfing and, you know, what he recommends for people. And he said, if you want a big wave surfer, you need to know that you really want it.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't be an external goal. You need to be like, I this is something that I really want to do, and I'm willing to pay a price, like the ultimate price, because it's the most dangerous kind of surfing you can do. And that always really stuck with me, because I've toggled my metabolism up and down year after year. And there are guys like Kai Lenny and Lucas Chumbo who will surf way fucking bigger waves than I ever will. And I'm so cool with that. I remember one day up at Mavericks a few years ago, there was these crazy numbers. And one thing that can happen at Mavericks is you get a south wind, which is it kind of goes sideways up the face and is really
devilish.
It's devilish and it's super dangerous. Makes it pretty much unsurfable.
I can't imagine.
But sometimes when there's south wind forecasted, it can go glassy for sections, and then it'll kick up again. But there were really big numbers, and I drove up by myself and just wanted to check it out. And there was a boat going out that I was able to get a spot on. And who was on it? Russell Bierke mm-hmm. was on it. Lucas Chumbo was on it.
Yeah. Two of the biggest heavy hitters in the
heavy
band.
Hitters. Who else? Hotman, you know, Othman, yeah. Symphony, the fucking Moroccan madman. Love Hotman. The fucking legend.
One of the great nicknames.
One of the great nicknames. Hotman, dude. Shout out to Hotman, dude. I went to Morocco last year, and that dude just styled me out so much. But those guys, and they were hungry for it, and it was just a scary, weird day. Paddled out there. Or we took a boat out, and we were sitting in the channel waiting for it, and all of a sudden we were seeing these sets coming through that were breaking 100 yards outside the main bowl. And I mean, it was probably 60-foot faced waves mm-hmm. coming through. Like the kind of waves that made me like so scared just to be on the boat. Like I was like, I don't know if I want to be in the ocean, like anywhere near the ocean right now. This kind of energy is so intimidating. And
it's almost like sorry to cut you off, but it's being in the proximity of waves and swell of a magnitude you didn't really think was possible. For me, it's like a quite psychedelic experience.
Very psychedelic.
There's a bit of ego death in it. Like, I was in a situation recently where, you know, this is not the kinds of conditions you're talking about, but just a very large swell with a long period and a really high tide, and it went flat for fucking 20 minutes. And then the mother of all sets came through, and we were sitting on the takeoff spot at this slab, and we had to start just paddling for the shore. And I remember just thinking, like, it was like a really like psychedelic moment where I was like, I had that feeling of like, you know, fucking nothing, you know, nothing. You think, you know, you fucking human, yeah. You know, nothing. You're an ant. Like, I felt like such an idiot in that moment. I felt like so filled with, like, you know, when the ego dissolves in those psychedelic experiences, you feel like such a dummy.
You feel like such an ant. It's a great way to put it. You feel like such an ant.
Scale that up to 60-foot oceans, and yeah, dude, I'm fucking telling that boat driver, like, yeah, man, can we, like, maybe...
Yeah, but I was out there, and Russell and Chumba, these guys were psyching.
Like, yeah, because these guys don't have fully formed prefrontal cortexes yeah. yet. The risk assessment part of their brain is still the size yeah. of a pea, and it will soon be the size of a squash ball by the time you hit your 30s. But yeah,
these it guys does change. Are, it yeah, does. It does change. But they're frothing. They're fucking out there. And I'm the only local, you know, guy from the area on the boat. So there's this feeling like,
you gotta rep the zone, dude.
Yeah, what? Like, I want to go get a bomb in front of you guys, and it was cool, man. I mean, I genuinely thought about my mentors, like the people who had taught me and kind of brought me into this community of big wave surfing, like Greg and Tyler, and I was just like, you know what? I don't need to do this. I don't need to do this. Nice. And I just sat on the boat.
Nice.
And watched those guys. A couple of them got fucking destroyed. Chumbo got one off the corner, and then the south wind killed it, and the session was over. One of the most memorable big wave sessions of my life.
Didn't hit the water. Amazing. I love it, dude. I love that restraint. I love that respect. To me, that is what respect for surfing in the ocean is. It's the very definition of it. Knowing your limits, man. And it's one of the real problems surfing faces is you so often are surfing around people who don't know and don't understand the limitations of their skill. And it's destroying the sport and the culture. It's a fucking nightmare, dude. It's making it so dangerous. So many waves are going unridden because of people like that. You know, it's a shocker.
I once listened to an episode with Tim Ferriss and Sam Harris, and they were talking about psychedelics, and they said, I don't think that anyone should talk about psychedelics until they've had a terrifying trip.
Yeah, dude.
And I feel the same way about big wave surfing, because you can go out and get a really big wave, or you can go out and get a couple really big waves. You could have a whole season where you don't really fall. And you start to feel invincible, and other guys are pulling back, and you're like, what? I got this. And it's only until you get rocked on one that you should be able to talk about it. Mm. Because then you know. And there are a lot of guys that I've seen who will get really psyched on surfing Mavericks, and then they'll get rocked on one, and they'll get a two-wave hold down or something, and you won't see them anymore. And that's not like bagging on them. That's like people just get to that point where they're like, fuck that. I thought I was going to die.
Mm.
And I don't want that to happen to me. Like I'm like, dude, I want to have a fun, long surf life. And I don't need to get to that point where I think that my life is going to be over. And I think that it takes a certain amount of restraint to have longevity.
For sure. Yeah, man. Well said. And, you know, really, at the end of the day, it is about fun. And for some people, fun comes in the form of challenging yourself and, you know, progressing, staying in the zone of proximal development, progressing mentally, physically, spiritually, and that can all come through surfing. But, yeah, you need to really be checking your intentions when the waves are of mortal coniquence. And, you know, speaking of cones of mortal coniquence, where were you in proximity to the Condor when he packed his all-time Mondo cone?
The Condor. I missed that session, unfortunately. I was out when he, and I had him on my podcast 2 weeks prior because he had also got another wave. He didn't get a barrel on it, but it was one of the best waves anyone had ever ridden at Mavericks. It was on the day that Kai Lenny was getting a lot of really good waves. It was Bluebird, Big As It Gets. Ian Walsh came over. Twiggy was out. I was just maxing perfect Mavericks. So I had Pete on the show and had him walk me through that wave, thinking it was, you know, wave of the winter. That was insane. And then 2 weeks later, he goes out and gets another one. I mean, that dude, I think he's 50.
Dude, I was just about to say that.
He's in it, and he's just so dialed. He spent so much time out there and has such a love for that wave. You know, he's out there all the time, just frothing. And he's such a skilled surfer. You know, he has this real low center of gravity, like wide stance, shreds on little waves,
yeah,
still.
Yeah, exactly.
And he, and doing all of his commentating work over the years, I think, too, has kept him in the circles of the best surfers in the world. So he knows what the best surfing in the world looks like. Mm-hmm. And I think that that can do a lot for people. Like when you're just surfing your local wave and you're only around your local, I mean, that's me, right? You're like, I'm ripping right now. And then you see a real pro surfer paddle out and they're just going at a velocity that you can't even fathom. Like you just don't know what you don't know. And I think that Pete is one of those guys who grew up in Santa Cruz where the level of surfing is high, but then spent his 40s around the top surfers in the world. And I think that that's in part kept him so sharp into his 50s.
Yeah, you can't be what you can't see. And I mean, it's so crazy that in our lifetime, we've seen surfing go from this sport that's done by people in their 20s into this martial art almost that's done by these fucking sensei shaman goats like Kelly Slater and Pete Mel, guys who are breaking performance barriers for all ages at like 50, man. It's fucking, like, and Grant Twiggy Baker's in that conversation too, like in Nathan Hedge, you know, like when the waves are serious, it's these dudes, like these old school veterans, these war horses who've been through the rigors of life and hardship and addiction and fucking who knows what. And they just cradle out of their caves and fucking
just with their walkers and then just find the best wave of the
That's
day.
That's it, man. Toss the Zimmer frame into the shrub, fucking put the rhino chaser under the arm. And
yeah, well, you know, we're here in Bali. I just had a chance to do a Mentawai trip for 2 weeks. And I found that I had this insight, which was that your physical frame and your fast twitch muscles start going down maybe in your 30s, but your wave selection can really go up as long as you're alive. Like your understanding of the ocean and the layers, it's this, the understanding the ocean is a language, and there are certain people who have done different things with language than others since the beginning of time, right? There are the Alan Wattses of the world, the Tim Learys, who can kind of weave together language in this way that's so masterful and poetic. And I think that there's a similar parallel to understanding the ocean. And you see someone like Peter Mel or Twiggy or Kelly Slater, and they have such depth of understanding of that language. And all they need to do is be in the right spot, and that wave will come to them.
Yeah, I mean, no better example of that. There is no better example of that than Kelly Slater in that Barron Mamiya heat at Pipeline. You know, fucking, it's like 10 seconds on the clock, sets come through, and he lets the first one go. Canelo gets like a 7 on it, but he crunched the numbers, like knew the frequency of sets compared to the amount of time left in the heat. It was such a tripped out thing. We had him explain it on our Margaret River podcasts with him. And gets the score on the death, comes out, like just lets go of the rail, still a section of the tube to go. It's remarkable, man. It's so, invigorating to see guys like that breaking these performance barriers into that age bracket. It just, obviously, how can it not be inspiring to know that we've got so much more of our surfing life to go than we ever could have expected? Like, fuck, man, when Oki won his world title in 99, he was 33 and it was unheard of. 33. Comical.
I just listened to a rad podcast with Sam Harris and a guy named Will Storr on the Waking Up app, and the title's called Status Games. And Will Storr wrote a book called Status Games, all about how humans value status, and that a lot of our civilization is built around our desire to gain status in certain areas, right? So surfing, that's one status game that we play. And how well you can play by those rules and attain status determines like how a lot of other people will treat you, right? Like,
yeah.
Money is another one.
And access to resources.
Access to resources,
being
right?
Waves, yeah.
And I think about this pretty often because I think that we're in this time where people are not playing enough different status games. So they'll do one thing where they'll only be playing the status game of how hard can I shred?
Mm.
And by the time they're 26, all of a sudden they feel their status start to drop in that game. And that's where a lot of mental health issues come into play, right? Because like, fuck, all I have is my Instagram followers and they think I do big airs, but now I can't do big airs anymore. And people start to spiral. And what this guy, Will Storr, said is that the key to psychological durability is to have a diversity of status games that you play.
Mm.
So you're like, I'm a surfer here. There's my status here. But I'm also really into stand-up comedy, or I'm really into ping pong, or I'm really into cryptocurrency. And I'm at various levels on these different status totem poles, but I'm actually getting comfortable and I'm sort of like cold plunging into these different games of status, and it's allowing me to become more psychologically durable as a result. And I thought that was such a cool framing even within surfing, right? Because you can play the how hard do I rip game, but you can also play these other games of like how was my wave selection today, or like how much did I enjoy it. And that is something that this podcast really stuck with me, because I think that I've sort of unwittingly been I've kind of known that but had never defined it in a way. And I've spent a lot of my time doing stuff besides surfing because I saw a lot of guys who put all of their eggs in that basket. And then, and we've all see it, you start to spiral because your whole identity is wrapped up right
100%.
There.
Yeah. It's something I've taken away from Brad Gerlach and his Wave Key program, or the conversations I've had with him about that. And it's just, the idea of nailing fundamentals. Exactly what you mentioned. It could be just something so simple like positioning in a takeoff. You can turn straight hand 2 foot closeouts into a really satisfying surf session just by getting the positioning and the drop perfect, 5 times in a row. Maybe you get a floater. It can be as enjoyable as pumping waves in which you get flogged on too many and don't make enough waves. Like that can be quite excruciating despite the fact that it was cooking. Mm-hmm. So it is. Yeah, about just nailing fundamentals and, just being really intentional before going surfing and keeping fun at the forefront of your mind. I love the idea of diversifying, man. Like, to be honest, surfing, as fun as it is, like, growing up in the city especially, it was considered quite shameful to identify as a surfer to any large degree. Yeah. Surfers were fucking nerds compared to the guy doing ram raids and ripping off 100 laptops out of, like those, the people, I guess the people who were popular where I'm from were like often like street thugs, criminals, you know, those guys, you know, bombing trains with graffiti cans, like, you know, boxers, footballers, and surfers were often like spindly, weak. You know, your ability to a cutback has very little translation into the real world. You quickly realize in the city, like, it's just not relevant to anything. You know, it's of more value in the social matrix of city living to be to have a propensity for violence, yeah, as askew as that is.
Yeah. And the girls were into bad boys.
Girls were into bad boys. And I mean, yeah, it was just a different cultural matrix. Yet now I kind of, when I live in surf towns, I live in a surf town now on the North Coast, and whenever I traverse surf towns like this, the conversations and the obsession with surfing is so full on. It wears me out real quick. I just don't have that much of an interest in it to the point. I just don't think it's healthy. I haven't permitted myself to take that much of an interest in one thing because I somehow knew deep down that it just wasn't that healthy.
Specialization is for insects. And I'll tell you, dude, I got a fucking full-time job now, dude. I moved down to LA this year and I got to search for waves and I got to grovel and I froth out. I fucking froth out harder than I ever have.
Mm-hmm.
And I surf a little less than I was, you know, I'll go a couple weeks without a session, but man, it keeps you hungry.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps you hungry. And it's, I'm learning new skills, you know, running Trends with Benefits, like seeing what a company is all about. And I'm part of a team. I've never been part of that. And it's just diversified the status games, you know,
exactly.
And I'm low status, you know, and I'm like,
exactly.
All right, this is interesting.
It's very humbling.
But it I think has allowed me a better relationship with my surfing than ever.
100%. There's no doubt about that, man. I'm really interested to know as well, you know, Santa Cruz is famous for methed up maniacs.
What are you talking about?
Giant,
man,
fucking waves. But
what?
But you're not that.
I haven't heard of that.
I mean, you're as far from that.
You haven't seen me on a Friday night, bro.
Friday to Monday. It's
fucking
just
Friday
fucking
till Monday.
On the glass, Bobby.
Sleep. What?
Yeah, I mean, the guys you mentioned, Tyler Fox, yourself, like, obviously, you know, the Santa Cruz University there, there's like this, it's kind of the home of the psychedelics movement, Northern California. You know, there's this incredible counterculture history there. Where do you fit on the spectrum there, I guess, of the culture, and what's it like sharing space with a surf culture that was so masculine, so methed up, and just all about sending it and fucking, you know, just diabolical mental health outcomes? I mean,
it's funny, you don't realize how different it is than most surf cultures until you leave.
Mm.
I just thought that it was really uncomfortable to be a Grom at the lane or at one of these surf spots because a lot of these guys would make it very uncomfortable for you. And you're just scared, frankly. And that if you're not from there, you're going to get snapped on. I always just thought that everywhere was like that. And part of me has a kind of pride in it. I mean, a little bit of sheepish pride. Like, so many places have just gone to Cookville with, you know, a bunch of Costco soft top wave riders. And there was something really rad about that, like, fuck you attitude, like Santa Cruz skateboards, with a lot of surf skate crossover, a lot of anti-establishment, which surfing was founded on. And there was a lot of pride growing up in that just very fast-paced culture. And growing up, we really did look up to a lot of these guys who were, I still think, you know, are really, I mean, they paved the way. Like, there was a time when aerial Santa Cruz was one of the pinnacle places where innovative aerial surfing was going down.
Like,
in the late 90s, early 2000s, you had Rat Boy, Barney doing incredible stuff. And I think that it might take some of that fuck you attitude to also have a lot of the innovation that comes with it. But there's a real dark side to it. And a lot of those guys died. You know, Barney died. They all got hooked on hard drugs. And we, growing up through my teens, I was real good friends with Nat Young. And we did get to see that. Still friends with Nat. And I think that he has done a lot for this culture of surf Santa Cruz to show the young generation that you don't need to do drugs to be cool.
Mm.
And you can let your surfing do the talking. Because he's gone further than any surfer in Santa Cruz ever has. One of the only world tour surfers from Santa Cruz and someone who's stayed on for year after year. We had Adam Riplogle and Chris Gallagher, who are from Santa Cruz.
Galley, J-Land Pro winner, fucking legend. Lovely guy. Yeah. Love Galley.
But I think that Nat has single-handedly done a lot to just have the kids not be into drugs. But I think that along with that, and maybe this is just surf culture in general, there is less localism than there was, which is there's the two sides to every coin, right? Like a lot of those spots are more crowded, but there isn't also that sense of fear in the lineup. I mean, it's still localized in certain areas, but I think that my group of friends got to see what happened to a lot of those older guys. We were at the age where we got to see the tailspin of that.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I don't know how much it was as a result, but I think a lot of us too, we had parents who kind of influenced us to like do surf contests or play games or like the idle hands kind of thing. We were always just occupied with more healthy activities, and that led to this generation of Santa Cruz surfers being really talented, and there are a lot of young guys who are coming up who fucking shred super hard, and most of them are have very good heads on their shoulders.
Mm, yeah, well, there's that saying that culture is a reaction to what came before.
I think so.
And it's proved in this case, as it so often is. And, I wrote a story actually for Stab called Localism is a Sickness. And what I meant by that, it was kind of the title's maybe taken the wrong way by certain people who didn't read the article. But what it actually means is that, you know, localism, if you are the local and you're practicing localism, you feel the need to lock down your area and try and control this resource, it will make you sick. You're ruining your day constantly if you're going out
constantly.
There and you're stressing out. Yeah. Like stress is the difference between what is and what you want it to be. So
that's
if
good.
Like every day you go surfing and there's kooks or people from out of town, like not, you know, sticking to the rules that you've laid out, this kind of arbitrary, often self-serving set of rules.
Yeah. Like 100% self-serving.
Yeah. Like you're making yourself sick, man. Like you're flooded. You're in fight and flight mode all the time. You're flooding your central nervous system with cortisol, and you know, cortisol cancels serotonin. So there is no hope that you can even experience joy and contentment. Doesn't matter how many pits you get. Doesn't matter how happy, like you think the wave quality or the control of these resources you think that's going to make you happy, but it just can't biochemically. And I think that was one piece of the jigsaw puzzle with a lot of these guys, and why they deteriorated so badly. But I think as well, I mean, just not being able to handle the come down of surfing waves of that size, just spending that amount of time in adrenalized, you know, heightened state, fuck man, there's a price to pay for that. Like I remember we interviewed Pete after his crazy one at Mavs, and he said like the whole next day he just locked himself in his office. Like he couldn't talk to anyone. You know, he was rattled just from the fucking come down from the release of chemicals. And then layer on top of that, like the culture of pro surfing at that time, you know, these events were sponsored by booze companies. The tour was rife with cocaine and just this kind of live fast, die young mentality. And, you know, any kind of mindfulness or like any kind of training, even physical training was looked upon like as jockish. Any kind of mindful training, people look at you like you're a fucking alien, dude. Have you meditated or did breath work on tour in the 90s? Like, are you kidding me?
I do think that some of the onus and responsibility should be put on some of the surf companies.
For sure.
From the 90s. Like I said earlier, your employer controls your mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these guys felt like they had to be party boys because that is what was hailed in surf media, right? And you're going to do, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. So I think that for a lot of those guys, they were getting celebrated by their sponsors and by the magazines, by everyone to be this person who could fucking shotgun beers and snort Scarface level lines of coke and then go surf big waves the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And they could for a while. Like for a while, I was like, I remember when Flea won his first Mavericks contest and he used the prize money to throw this rager at this hotel called the Dream Inn and then had to spend all the prize money on hotel repairs. And I thought that was fucking sick. I was like, that's so rad. And you know, and but it's so, but it kind of is.
It kind of is. Like, here's the, so much of our podcast is dedicated to the folklore and the folk tales that emerge from this culture. But at the same time, we're also really honest about the corpses and casualties it leaves in its wake. It's undeniable, man. Some of the greats have died so prematurely or, you know, barely scraped through addiction and rehab. And they're all telling their stories now. And full credit to all those who have made it through that journey of
Flea is one of them. I mean, I think that Flea is a real example of someone who's come out the other side and now has a rehab program called Fleahab.
I love it. Yeah,
and is bringing ex addicts through this program where he incorporates surfing into it. He incorporates a lot of really healthy practices, and he's done a lot, man. I mean, that he's a brave soul who has made it through the fire, and I have a lot of respect for Daryl Flea Roscoe.
100%. What an icon. Fuck. Kobe, the same thing, man. You know, he went through OxyContin addiction on the back of a back injury that he had. You know, he prescribed those pills by his doctor for, you know, as he explained, you know, a doctor he trusted his whole life. He goes in there with what is essentially a chronic back injury that could have been cured with yoga and stretching. Instead, this fucking old white-haired dude goes, oh, well, these are on the market, mate. They're on the pharmaceutical benefits scheme, and the government's giving away free of these, mate. So he's fucking on the oxys, he's addicted, and he gets off it, and now he runs almost the identical program where people come to Bali, and they just basically get on his, like, spiritual boot camp, which is just fucking, you know, Wim Hof and, you know, exercising and surfing and community. Like, he's kind of created this. Basically, what survived him through addiction, he's created that, and that's now his medicine for people who are coming to him fucked up.
I wonder, I've never thought of this, I wonder how much diversifying your status games would make you less likely to become a drug addict. Because if you're a lot of, Gabor Mate he wrote a great book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, and it's about addiction, and he says addiction isn't the problem, addiction is the person's attempt to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. always trying to medicate pain and trauma away, basically, it seems to me.
And I wonder how much diversifying your life and your skill set, I'm just thinking of this right now, would allow you to not have your identity so wrapped up in one thing and have those crazy swings if you've hung your hat just on that one thing.
And moderating these status activities, right. You know, like, instead of it being about surfing and, you know, these kind of like ultra competitive pursuits, like, why not make it about fucking Qigong or chess or, like, you know, really like really nerdy kind of low end, high serotonin activities. I feel like there's just this, it's really deeply etched into masculine culture. There's this kind of aversion to just calm, lame, little fun things like, you know, knitting or yeah, painting or fucking reading a book or like having a book club. Like, we had a book club on the North Coast recently.
Oh, that's radical.
You know, it turned into fucking smoking joints the size of my forearm and doing group Wim Hof and getting in the ice baths together. But fuck, it was good, man. It was so good to connect like that with other men and in this, you know, really an interesting thing. Like, status to me confers some kind of competition, which I kind of like. I wonder how these kind of more ancient religions and you know, creeds would view something like that. So, like, I always kind of check my value system against what I know about, say, Tibetan Buddhism or something like that. You know, it's all about, and Balinese Hinduism, where it's all about just paying it forward with good karma and being kind to each other, and you know, practicing meditation and yoga and taking care of your community and your family. I don't see a lot of like status in that, in a, but maybe I don't understand status correctly. It's like seems so selfless to me.
Sure. So in a lot of hunter-gatherer cultures, they were fiercely egalitarian. So if you went off and shot a big deer and you thought that you were hot shit, the tribe would literally surround you and make fun of you. And they'd be like, what would you do for bringing that little bag of bones back? Who do you think you are? And it was a mechanism to keep status in check, because they realized that humans we just are status oriented. We like doing things and we like getting better at things and raising our status through that. But they knew how out of control that could get. Right? You could, you know, turn into Donald Trump if unchecked.
Mm.
So they had a lot of these mechanisms in place through humor and heckling, which could keep people in order. And I think that, like, dude, just fucking lighthearted heckles among friend groups are a very human thing, because it keeps people in check. So throughout history, we have had cultural setups that did keep people in check. And a lot of it was used through humor.
Man, that's so interesting, because in Australia, we are often written off for having this really virulent strain of tall poppy syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And, but maybe we're just like ultra evolved, or like, or maybe not evolved at all. We're just kind of Neanderthals still, but that's how we should have stayed.
Well, I think that
hunter gatherers, sorry.
I think that what tall poppy, I love the term tall poppy syndrome. And I think that, where that can become really dangerous is when your social group is tearing you down for trying new things,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? It's like, what, you're gonna try Qigong, you fag?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you? And then you see a lot of teenagers who are afraid to try new things,
mm-hmm.
because they're terrified of what their friends are gonna think of them. They're going, oh, they're gonna think I'm weird, so they only surf, they only do what's cool. And this has just become metastasized with social media, where people are comparing themselves to everyone else all the time. So I think that, like, my view of tall poppy syndrome is that it can get dangerous when you're afraid to try new things because of what you think your friends are going to think of you. But it can be, it's really helpful when you're all playing the same status game and you are just heckling each other if you think you got the barrel of the day.
100%.
And you're talking about it. 100%.
Man, I'm really keen to get into some of your achievements, because fuck, dude, you've lived a fucking an incredibly decorated life. You went to Gaia University, where you got a degree in green business. I'm really interested to know. I mean, what did your fucking certificate come on, a banana leaf?
It came in a banana leaf. Yeah, actually.
That's amazing.
They smeared period blood on a banana leaf and did a moon circle around me, and I got my degree. It was amazing. It was a pretty hipty dipty little school, but it was done completely remote. So when I was 18, I wanted to be a documentary filmmaker. I think ever since I was a teenager, I've always romanticized journalists. I always thought that the early Vice guys were so sick. Those were like my heroes. I would just watch YouTube videos of guys like Thomas Morton and Ryan Duffy and like early Shane Smith just going out telling badass stories. My dad is a filmmaker, so I had some of those skills early on, just knowing storytelling. And I have always been drawn to that. So I saw surfing as a way to couple that desire to basically like do some form of vice myself, as a way to be able to spend my early 20s. And Gaia University was a school that gave me credit to go out and do the Surfing for Change series.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the work that I was doing on these documentaries was school credit. And I think that it provided a lot of skills that I use now in terms of time management and deadline setting, and being self-motivated to just pick up the fucking phone and call someone to, you know, like I just have no problem like walking up to someone and being like, hey, will you be in this film I'm doing? You probably have a bit of this too, right? You're just like a bit of a battering ram. Like,
how to
going,
develop it. Yeah.
You have to develop it.
Man, it goes against every cell in my body to go and bother people I don't know, especially, you know, people with high profiles. Fuck, that was a torturous part of my job, having to, you know, talk and pester my fucking yeah. childhood heroes. It was rattling. Oh, man, it was so gnarly.
But it's such a good skill to develop, because in school, if you're just given assignments to do, you become a worker bee, and you don't know how to be a self-starter, and you don't know how to, you don't learn how to manage your time in a way that can allow you to meet that deadline a month, 2 months down the road. So I think that I gained a lot of those skills, but I think I missed out on some of the social aspects of college that I wish I would have had. I think I've had to do some catch up in like just basic shit like math or writing. I was not a very like bookish or reader, much of a reader, really until my mid-20s, and then a switch flipped for me and I just became psychopathic about becoming a skilled reader and writer. But the Surfing for Change and Gaia University period, I felt like was really helpful just in learning how to go out and do stuff myself.
Man, talk to us a bit about this Surfing for Change project. You know, what were the real lessons learned in it? What were the peak experiences, the memorable stories that you told?
Yeah, I had early success because I, like you've mentioned this before, are as a journalist drawn to where the money goes. They say if a story doesn't make sense, follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as a surfer, was interested in environmental stories, but found that the deck was so stacked against environmental initiatives that there was just a really big problem, because all the money was going to corporations like ExxonMobil and Chase Bank and the like. And I actually found that, a lot of environmental projects are, they need a financier. They need a bank to underwrite the project. And not all banks are created equally. I think I might have talked about this last time on the podcast, but where you put your money and depending on the environmental philosophy of your bank, it determines how they're going to lend your money out and which projects they're going to underwrite. So when I was 18, the first Surfing for Change short film I made was about this proposed coal power plant down in Chile, right along this sick left, and it was being underwritten by Bank of America, which at the time was one of the largest financiers of coal power. And I was kind of just this grom talking about how if you put your money into a local bank, it's lent out, but it tends to be lent out only within your community and to local businesses that can help your neighborhood thrive. That video sort of went viral, and I got a lot of media around that project, which I think I've learned a few things. It's a good question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me the question of like, what were the lessons learned through the whole series? And that project had so much success, I kind of just thought that I could do any video and it would be awesome and get a lot of media attention. But it was a bit like winning the jackpot on your first go. Because I was getting articles in major media outlets about this project that I did, and I just thought like, oh cool, I can do this every time and it's gonna hit. So in the subsequent years, I did short pieces on the clothing industry. I did pieces on plastic pollution. I did a piece on a proposed nuclear power plant in J-Bay. I actually came here to Uluwatu to do one on the trash epidemic in Bali. And I learned a ton about storytelling. I had great experience meeting people, you know, learning how to cobble together footage and edit it, but none of them really hit like that first one. And often people are still like, oh, you're the dude who did the banking piece. And I think that what I've learned since then is that you need a certain, it's very helpful to have a certain level of novelty within a story and the connection of unlikely worlds. So that was a piece where this surfer was talking about the banking system. And that all of a sudden people in their minds don't know how to place that or categorize you or write you off. So it draws in interest. And I think that a really powerful just form of making stories work is to show unlikely connections and tell those stories. Where if you're just a surfer doing a story on plastic pollution, it's like fucking yawn. I don't care. But it's like that saying, like, dog bites a man isn't a story, but man bites dog is a story. So since then, I've found that more novelty and more connection of disparate worlds can be a really good method for making stories that actually hit.
And in terms of, you know, what did you learn about the systems that govern this world? Like, is there a way that you can sum it up, you know, in a fairly simple way? Like, there is some incredible system failures in this matrix. It was really simply put by Yanis Varoufakis on Democracy Now! I listened to an interview with him. Do you know Yanis Varoufakis?
No, I love Democracy Now!
Yeah, well, that's another one of my go-to podcasts. He was the finance minister for Syriza in Greece. And, you know, just he's a socialist. He was a heavy hitting politician in Greece at a time of incredible financial upheaval when, Greece's economy collapsed and, you know, Germany came knocking for fucking millions of dollars in debt that they thought they were owed. And Greece said, hey, you still haven't paid us our debt from World War One. We're not paying your fucking debt, which right, I thought right. was so funny.
Yeah, that was a gangster
hilarious,
move.
Dude. I mean, that whole story is so fucking funny to me. It's like this country is like the birthplace of fucking philosophy. Like, they are not idiots. Like, they were just living off credit. And Germany's buying up this debt going, oh, like, yeah, we're going to get all this money someday. And then when it all went tits up, they're like, yeah, we're not paying. What are you going to do about
gangster.
It? We're going to invade.
So gangster.
You're going to invade us? But anyway, Varoufakis, he's written a book. I've forgotten about it and what the name of it is now. But he just made the point that the system works as simply as this. And you really touched on this with your banking TEDx and your banking episode, where it's like the Reserve Bank prints the money.
Federal Reserve
prints the money. That money is given to banks. And those banks fund infrastructure projects. The infrastructure projects that the banks fund, the investment banks, say your Goldman Sachs and whoever else, are almost always fossil fuel infrastructure products, infrastructure projects. They're bankrolling. Essentially, the Federal Reserve is bankrolling all of these ultra-crooked industries and infrastructure projects, which where that affects the common man, like we're all doing jobs, we're slaving in service of forces that are underpinned by the Federal Reserve. It's insane. Like, you know, petrochemical companies, I guess, you know, they underpin the cost of so many things. Like, the cost of petrol goes up. Like, I'm starting to get a bit lost in the miasma of the matrix.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
That fucking reeks to me, that system. How is that possible?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, one of my heroes is Matt Taibbi.
Yeah. Incredible journalist. Incredible writer on finance.
Yes. And he had a great line, a great opening line in one of his Rolling Stone articles, which is, referring to Goldman Sachs, and he says, the world's greatest investment, the world's largest investment bank is a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money.
Wow.
Well, I had him on the podcast, and he said that the, so we haven't touched on this, but, I did a satirical awards show called the Motherfucker Awards.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Taibbi hosted it. Is that right? Or he presented an award that.
Yeah. So Taibbi presented a Motherfucker Award. So these were, it was a satirical Academy Awards style show where we celebrated the corporations that fucked Mother Earth.
Nice.
And we got comedians to deliver acceptance speeches as the heads of JP Morgan Chase, the number one financier of tar sands, dirty energy globally, Purdue Pharmaceutical, the corporation that brought OxyContin to the world. We got the comedian Simon Rex, aka Dirt Nasty, to present as the head of Purdue Pharmaceutical.
Which like, is actually
Purdue Pharmaceutical, your pain is our gain. and we got Taibbi to present the one for JP Morgan Chase. We got these great comedians, Natasha Leggero and Moshe Kasher, who are a husband and wife comedian couple, and they came up as pretending to be the brother and sister heirs of JP Morgan Chase, and they're acceptance speech was about how they were in an incestuous romantic relationship and the only thing that made them horny was financing dirty energy. It was fucking so brilliant. But we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun doing that. I co-created that show with a guy named Chris Ryan, who's been another real mentor of mine. He wrote a book called Sex at Dawn, which was a bestseller all about the prehistory of human sexuality. Big thinker. He wrote a more recent book called Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. And we were chatting one day about how Earth Day was coming up. And it's such a smug holiday because everyone's kind of talking about, hey, Mother Earth. And we're like, but Mother Earth is losing. We should be celebrating the winners here. So we're like, we should be celebrating the ones that are fucking Mother Earth. Like, ding, ding, the Motherfucker Awards. So we presented that 2 years in a row. It was so much fun, so much work, and kind of unsustainable. And then COVID hit, so we stopped doing it. And now I work at Mudwater. So I think that we did it 2 years. I felt good about it. It's going down as legendary. But Taibbi, when I interviewed him, I kind of asked him a similar question, and he said, you know, all of your winners, all the motherfuckers, have one thing in common, which is that they have sociopathic business models.
Mm.
And I think that where a lot of people go wrong in their thinking about the problem is they think that just government at large is the problem. And they then will vote in ways that go against their interests, and they'll gut organizations that are government organizations that are really the only mechanism to keep a lot of these corporations with sociopathic business models in check.
Mm.
So I think that the current cultural attitude towards the government is unwittingly pushing a lot of really danger, a lot of environmental policies that are put in place to keep the air clean and the water clean. They're pushing a lot of that to the side. So I think that it's just important and that's not to say that government doesn't have really overbearing policies and that we should also be very critical of government itself. But the fact is that just because a company like Coca-Cola or JP Morgan Chase has a great marketing team doesn't mean that they're not deeply sociopathic. And your government representative is really one of the only people who can help keep that in check.
Mm, And the investors themselves.
The investors themselves.
I mean, the reason they're sociopathic is because they answer to nothing else but the profit dividends for those invested in these companies. So you've got this millions upon millions of people worldwide, you know, middle class, upper middle class, maybe even working class, probably working class trying to get into the middle class, who are invested in these nihilistic corporations in a bid to get ahead and get out of this debt-crushing system that they're in. This,
yeah. And that's also to, like, I really want to be careful here because I don't think that people who work at JP Morgan Chase or Coke or any of these big corporations are necessarily bad people. I think that most people just get into the system and are trying to make their life work. But now being inside a fast growing corporation, you know, Mudwater is trying to become a billion-dollar corporation. I will say that the opinion of the public matters a lot more than most people think they do. Hmm. Like if you get 50 people to all call a company on the same day and you actually organize, you'd be amazed how sensitive these companies are to public perception. So you are actually more powerful than you think. And I have had just a little taste of that now being on teams, you know, at a fast growing company.
And boycotts are always a good one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a public showing of solidarity in the face of a crooked corporation or institution that have been so effective.
I think that if we redirected a lot of our public shaming against you know, a lot of individuals, some of which who deserve it, but a lot of which who don't, and we redirected that at sociopathic corporations, it could do a lot.
I mean, every dollar is a vote in capitalism, but sadly, so many people are so short of a dollar that they have to do desperate things for a buck, and that often involves, you know, bankrolling fucking crooked corporations just because they're desperate to get out of this fucking crushing vice that has been created by a system that creates a simulation of scarcity. Or it's not a simulation. The scarcity is felt, but it doesn't need to be there. I mean, there's people with more money than can be spent in several lifetimes, and, you know, there's just so much stored up productivity. One of the crazy things, one of the crazy statistics I came across that really just shattered my hope in the future of capitalism was that, man, like around about the year 2000, technology got to a point where the productivity just accelerated to such an insane degree. Like, fuck, man, we were now capable of cultivating food on a scale that was just a billion times larger because of certain automation of, you know, certain key agricultural devices. Same with computers. And we just had this crazy productivity boom around about the year 2000. And what should have happened at that point was that productivity got passed down to the workers, i.e. fucking everyone on the planet. What actually happened is that productivity got sucked up into the bank accounts of Jeff Bezos and the like, and employee wages have stayed more or less flat while CEO wages have gone up like 937% and shit like that. And the whole system is so weighted in the direction of the global investor class, the global elite, the rich, that, you know, they've bought governments, like they've bought media outlets, like Bezos literally owns the Washington Post, like, you know. So our instruments for change and culpability have been so deeply corrupted by the rich that there's really no hope. And it just seems to me that we're sailing in this direction literally with fucking super yachts, which is like the biggest and best waste of money there is. Like the global elites need to have the most ornate,
besides a Costco surfboard, of course.
That's that's it. I mean, they're two sides of the same coin. They're both barely seaworthy vessels at the end of the day.
Well played.
But I mean, so, you know, super yachts are just this fucking tremendous waste of money because it's a place to hide capital. They need somewhere to put their money because they can't put it anywhere else. They can't even put it into housing because if they were to do that, they'd have to have a house the size of fucking, I don't know, New Zealand or some shit to hide all that money. It'd have to be like so big. So they put it in these insanely stupid vessels. And anyway, I guess we're just heading in this direction where it's almost getting to a point where the rich of the rich, the orchestrators of the system, the people, you know, every dollar's a vote. These people have fucking billions of votes to your one. And we're heading in this direction where they're buying up big slices of land in New Zealand. They're buying these fucking crazy boats. It's almost like, are we heading for some like Noah's Ark apocalypse where Bezos and the like are just going to be sailing rings around the world while we're all fucking underwater? I mean, it's kind of seems to be where we're heading, like with climate change and sea levels rising. It's all a bit paranoid and apocalyptic, but that is literally, that's not a lie. Like what I just said is actually the direction that we're heading with climate change and, you know, the potential of water wars and, you know, incredible levels of drought and the fucking destruction of cultivatable land and the scarcity increasing. Like, fuck, man, it's a scary time. And I'd be interested to know, what is your faith in capitalism at this point? Because the last time you're on the podcast, you and old man Weisberg fucking double teamed me on capitalism versus socialism.
Did we?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez, I don't remember that.
You're like, anyway, we got into it a little bit in brief, but I actually listened to an incredible podcast with Lex Fridman. He interviewed Steve Keen, who's actually a surfer. You should get this guy on your podcast. I couldn't get a contact for him, sadly. I was trying to get him on mine, but maybe you can do better. Steve Keen, he's a Sydney University professor, and he surfs, and he fucking is like the leading thinker in Marxist economics. And his interpretation of, or his understanding of, parallel systems to capitalism is second to none. And what he explained was, I think it was in Marx's explanation of the way capitalism would work, it was that capitalism would come before socialism. Capitalism would be a necessary step to get to socialism. And capitalism has served its purpose in that it has generated incredible levels of productivity and abundance. It's just that it's all being withheld by elites. And I don't know what we do about that. I don't know if we sharpen the fucking guillotines or, I mean, I don't know how we shake them down, man, but it's got to be done. It's got to be done quickly.
So do you think that when you're talking about socialism, do you think that that should include the government taking over the means of production of goods?
Because the
argument for capitalism is like, well, the genius of capitalism is competition. And if you had the government being the only shop in town that's producing cell phones would suck and they would cost thousands of dollars. But because you have competing organizations, you're going to get a better product out of it.
And we did. We got a great product. And that product was a technological boom like no other. And a boom in education and understanding and awareness that is fucking on it, the steepest ascent. Like it's going off the graph right now, human intelligence. But, and, you know, it's also plateauing due to, you know, the dumbing down of food, water, fucking educational systems. But the competition, it got us to this point. It was essential. But now, everything's so weighted. Like what I'm saying, I don't really understand what socialism is necessarily. I understand a few key principles of it. In Australia, we've had several socialist prime ministers and they've given us things like universal healthcare and public housing near the beach. You know, like, fuck, and high wages for workers. It's the workers' paradise. A tradesman earns fucking crazy money. A cleaner earns crazy money in Australia. And so they fucking should. That is an essential job. They should earn much more money than a fucking banker or a lawyer or a journalist. I mean, sadly.
Journalists are making that much money.
They're making pretty shit money.
I think that, let's talk about it for a bit because someone once explained it to me that in America, we have two systems. We have socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. Mm-hmm. So when the banks needed to get bailed out in 2008, that was a socialist move, right? If they were to just let them fail, that would have been true capitalism. But what we have now is two different systems, and that to me seems very unfair. So I think that a redistribution of resources, even just taking some money out of the military budget and putting that into things like housing, things like universal basic income, I think would make our system a lot better, and I think they would really improve the mental health of the people. So I'm a big fan of Andrew Yang. I'm a fan of the idea of a universal basic income. Mm-hmm.
As was applied in Dolphin, Canada, and several other, there was trial versions of this that were done, and even like the Nixon government was in favor of it in the 70s. Like
it's your money, right? Like you paid the taxes. Mm. It's your money. Why would you not want that as a benefit? And for as much bureaucracy as there is within the government, one thing that they can do is cut checks. And what they've found in a lot of these test studies, which they've done in stocks in California, in Los Angeles, California, is that people use the money for things like car repair, childcare, like things that very much benefit yourself. And I think that it would do a huge amount to just not have so many people redlining, because such a huge percentage of people in America right now don't have $500 saved. 70% of Americans, I'm not going to say the stat actually, because I don't have it off my head, but it's a fucking huge amount of Americans that are barely getting by. Mm. And I think that that's an example of a lot of conservative ideology right now taking holds with the poor and lower middle class and getting them to vote further right, which is never going to end up with a policy where you could get something like universal basic income. And that, to me, is an example of people voting against their interests. And I think they've kind of co-opted or used a lot of the stupidity of the messaging of woke culture to do things like, oh, this is woke capitalism. This is and that when they do that, because it's so unattractive right now in America to be seen as woke and be seen as this uber sensitive kind of cancel culture type person, I've seen a lot of people unwittingly move further right in their political dispositions just because they don't want to be seen as woke.
You know what? You want to hear my paranoid conspiracy theory about what woke, the origins of woke politics?
Sure.
My take on woke politics and identity politics is that it could potentially be CIA psyops.
That's your side.
And it's been, because they have been trying to fracture the left into a million pieces for fucking a long time, man. Probably since the 1950s, 1940s of Red Scares and the whole way through. And this is the most successful attempt at it yet, because they have managed to convince left people to do the work for them. The left-wing politics, it's always about class, man. It's always about fucking cash flow. And it's always about money. Like, in this system, like, money is just time and it's stored up stress. Like, you know, fucking waving rainbow flags and, like, you know, all the, like, woke, well, political correct language and shit. It is no substitute for cold, hard currency in your hand. It's no substitute for the ability to, you know, feed your family, get healthcare for your family, house your family. Like, it's always been about class, man. The left always understood that, and somehow we've forgotten that. Woke politics never talks about class, man. And the people who never talk about class in that woke realm, they're always middle class and upper middle class, man. And they're coming out of these imperial institutions like your Harvards, your Yales, I mean, your Berkeleys, like, yeah, as countercultural and educational as they might seem, these institutions are still, at the end of the day, like American institutions. America is being the home of capitalism and, it's being so, the world police, the home of the military industrial complex, you know, probably killed more people than the Nazis since the end of World War II. Like, the US administration, American people, beautiful people. Some of my favorite people are American people, but the system is fucked up there, man, and we're all paying a price for it.
I think you said it really beautifully, which is that it was a very big mistake for the movement to focus on race instead of class. And when you had thinkers like George Orwell, they were distinctly focused on class.
Mate, Malcolm X was distinctly focused on class. Angela Davis was distinctly focused on class. These were some of the biggest and most boisterous and bombastic black thinkers of their time. They got it. Of course they got it, man. Fuck.
Like, right, but to have the care of the movement shift only towards race and gender alienates such a huge segment of the American population, right? Which is
every fucking working person
out there.
Shifts them all to the right.
Shifts them all to the right immediately. And I don't think that's a CIA conspiracy.
It reeks of MK Ultra, dude. It's one shade off it.
If I didn't know so many woke people from Santa Cruz, I would probably believe that. But I
know so many of them too. But
here's my theory.
It's not that, look, it's not that the woke people don't realize that they go along with the trend that's coming out of the universities.
You think the idea came from CIA and they're like, this is a very seductive idea to fracture the left.
Via universities, which are at their core often imperial institutions, man. You cannot trust necessarily what is taught in universities. And man, Steve Keen, the guy I just mentioned who was on the Lex Fridman podcast, is a great example of that. He talks about leading student boycotts because this sandstone university, Sydney University, was sidelining certain lecturers because of more radical or more truth based teachings, and they were getting sacked and the students would boycott and he would lead them. So like, man, don't put all your faith in institutions like universities and the teachers that they've got there, that they can be gotten to, man. Everyone has a price.
Here's my theory.
Go on.
On the rise of woke culture. I think that it is the result of young people being spiritually bereft. So throughout history, it was usually the religious institutions that controlled the beliefs of people. And even in the United States, it was up until pretty recently, Christianity and that story controlled the actions of great numbers of people. And I think that when millennials started to grow up, the result of the Catholic Church being unveiled, a lot of these stories were just unbelievable. And I think that came along with this idea and this feeling that a lot of young people had that they were powerless and that they didn't matter. And that's a really scary place to sit psychologically. When you don't have something to spiritually hang your hat on. Mm. You don't feel powerful, and they then attached a kind of religious fervor, which is woke culture, to secular issues. So that is what you get when, if you want to talk about a really complex subject like race or racism and having a different opinion and being shut down by that person, shut down, or we're going to cancel you. That reeks of religious and dogmatic ideology.
Mm.
So I think that it's people placing their spirituality, a kind of spiritual barren landscape, into secular issues.
Yeah, well said. And I have heard that theory. And yeah, I mean, look, it's probably the more realistic. But I think, man, there's been some incredible sleight of hand that's occurred in left-wing politics. And I cannot believe that the microphone has been passed to these, like, shrieking, blue-haired fucking vegans who go around calling people privileged because they have white skin. It's like, dude, like, have you been to Scotland or England or Ireland? There is fucking hundreds of thousands of people living in housing projects who are all white. They're like straddling poverty. Have you ever been to a factory? Have you ever worked in a factory? Like, or have you ever been a bricklayer on a cold morning in fucking the north of England? Like, do you, like, have you ever tested your academic theory on these people? Have you ever gone to a building site where some guys, you know, maybe in Australia or America, he's fucking sweating bricks, mixing cement. And have you ever gone, hey, buddy, like, you're privileged, man, because you got white skin. Like, test your academic theories in the real world before you start spraying them everywhere.
Well, I think that you also always need to be persuasive, and woke stories are not persuasive. So it's not to say that racism doesn't exist. I mean, if you look purely at the economics between black and white people in America, it's stark. The household income between the average white person and average black person is stark. And you're like, okay, this is a big problem here. But is the best way to tackle it to call every white person that makes a faux pas a racist and get them fired? That's not a very persuasive way to call people into your movement. And if you look at one of Martin Luther King's great geniuses, was the framing of the civil rights movement was very much one of a call-in culture. So he would say things like, we are all brothers and sisters of God, and some of our brothers and sisters are not being treated with the same dignity mm-hmm. as others. You had a whole movement that was making abjectly racist people want to listen and want to get involved and be part of the music, be part of the art. And it became something that was irresistible and made and was responsible for a lot of the progress that we've seen over the last 60 years. And it's because that message was so persuasive. And he knew that. That guy was a fucking smart dude.
Well, he was channeling God, man, literally. Like, you know, he would, I'm sure he prayed, which is a lot, which is essentially meditation. You know, if you want to do breath work and meditate and pray, you channel the Buddha nature, you channel the Christ consciousness. What comes spewing out of your mouth is like a direct line to, I don't know what it is, man, the source, God, the fucking, like, just the pure truth. It's like something else is acting through you. It's a beautiful thing, but we've lost touch with these structures, these daily rituals and practices.
Right. Like, now if you want to be part of that woke movement, which is just fracturing day by day, what's the benefit? Like, if I want to toe the line with you, like, what, I get to sit with you? Like, this isn't a fun, exciting movement. So I think that to anyone listening who wants to be persuasive and change hearts and minds of people, think about Martin Luther King's strategy of drawing these big circles and drawing and bringing people in and knowing that you're going to have a lot of imperfect allies. And that's what it takes to make real change happen.
Solidarity, working class solidarity. It's an old school concept of the left. It's been forgotten. We got to bring it back. I guess the other thing we're up against, man, and this is the, when I think about this is when I think, like, fuck, maybe the only way out is just to sharpen the guillotines. Like, think about this. I've had a couple mates work on super yachts in the Mediterranean as mechanics and as captains even. And, you know, I'm talking like, guys who they've been working for, like, you know, tabloid owners in Britain and shit like that, like some of the most influential people in the Western world, and like they've been on boats that have been filled with Russian oligarchs and shit like that. And what I've learned is that at the pointy end of wealth and power on this planet, what the people are doing, what those people with all the money and power, what they're doing, it boils down to high-class prostitutes and fucking bowls of cocaine. They're snorting themselves stupid, and they're fucking the hottest chicks money can buy. And when that loses its luster, they go and they fuck kids like Jeffrey Epstein and whoever was hanging out on that island. These people are fucking reptiles, dude. And when you don't practice any kind of spiritual practice, any service over self, man, it's a miserable existence. And the only way you can feel anything is through, like, uppers, like cocaine uppers. It's through power and it's through fucking. And these people, this is what they do. And these are the heaviest hitters on the planet, because they don't, they've just worshipped materialism and consumerism their entire existences. They don't know any different. They're kind of too far down the track to turn back, and they're just nihilistic. They're like, well, I'm going to be fine. Fuck. Like, my family's going to be fine, and I'm going to get to fuck, like, 21-year-old, like, Eastern European chicks for the rest of my days before I, you know, die on the toilet of a cocaine fucking heart attack.
Got to get these guys on breath work.
Yeah, it's literally, dude. Seriously, man. That's where it's gotten to, and that's where we're at, funnily enough. And it's coming from the grassroots, and it's going up, just like the Balinese do it with their karma, and you know, that's a way of taking back control, treating people kind. Every person in the society treats people kind, and it's this compounding force of goodness that goes up, and that's the only place change is going to come from. It's going to come from the bottom, and it's going to go up, because it ain't coming from the top going down, sadly.
I got a plug before we wrap up.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was out, I think that we've gone pretty up into the 10,000-foot view of problems with the world, and I want to ground it down so that people don't drive off the fucking road right now. I think it's all over. I'm not leaving with reptiles, bro. I refuse to have my parting thought on the podcast be one of fucking kids and reptiles.
The lizard brain.
Not the lizard brain. So in Bali and in Southeast Asia, number one cause of death among children is drowning.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know this, but kids in Bali drown at astounding rates, falling into rivers. Big issue that I had no idea about before coming over here, but was turned on to this local organization called SwimDo. Most people in the surf world don't know about this organization. They've been around just the past few years. They're based right at the back of Karamas, which most people will know is an epic surf spot. And they've taught thousands of young Indo kids this survival swimming backstroke.
Amazing.
That can save their life if they fall into a river. And I'm writing a story on SwimDo, and they are looking for volunteers who could be swim instructors. So on your next trip to Bali, if you want to give back and do some work teaching local kids how to swim, the organization's growing, and they're doing classes in Java. They've done a class in Borneo, and it's just an awesome local organization. And you know, as they say, don't try and change the world, just try and change your block. So
100%.
Next time on your surf trip, look up SwimDo, send them an email, and send them some money or some skills, and they'd be grateful.
It's the future of surf travel, man. On the flat days, go and do some shit for the community. Go and chip in, go and rip in. Fucking love that. Great way to end the pod, man. It's been a journey. Go on, you, Carl. You're a fucking legend, man.
I really enjoy it, man. You're the man.
Love you, brother. You.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, click the link below and sign up for my Substack newsletter. Every Friday, I send one newsletter with a new word that I learned or think is cool and write a little something about that word. So if you love growing your vocabulary, if you're the kind of weirdo who thinks that reading is sexy, click the link below or go to tierman.substack.com. That's tierman.substack.com to sign up for the weekly newsletter. Thank you to everyone who donates to this podcast via Substack. I rely on listeners like you to keep this thing going. So if you have some extra change, if this is the kind of thing that you want to support, I very much appreciate those paid subscriptions. And if you don't have the cash, just sign up for it for free. No big deal. Go be a good person. Get out into the water, whatever body of water is closest to you. Lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.